Hi, welcome again to the assembled L'chol HaMazinim. We're discussing tonight the centurion of the 17th century, sponsored again by Becky and Avi Katz, L'ilui Nishmas Yonah ben Rav Aryeh Leib. The 17th century was remarkable both for Jewish scholarship and Jewish heresy. The defining work of the 16th century, discussed last time, the Shulchan Aruch, was expanded and clarified by commentators who became celebrities in every base measure since. The Bach, who wrote primarily on the Tur, but he amended many passages in the Talmud as well, but especially the Taz, who was the Bach's son-in-law, and the Shach, and the Magen Avraham, and the Chalkas Mechokek, and the Beishol, everything subsequent is really a commentary on these commentaries on the Shulchan Aruch. And in the 17th century, Jews settled for the first time in the New World, in the Americas, and Yiddish became the majority language of the Jewish people. In the 17th century, the first famous heretic appeared, Benedict Spinoza, lived a relatively short life, 1632 to 1677. He's a student in Yeshiva Eitz Chaim in Amsterdam. He's a brilliant but eccentric personality, remember that phrase, who fell as a young man into non-Jewish philosophical circles, intellectual speculators, and he went off the derech in 1654 after finishing the year of Kaddish for his father. Spinoza began propagating his views in the Jewish community, primarily that God is nature and nature is God. He was a pantheist. He denied Torah and Hashemayim, denied prophecy, denied divine providence, mitzvos, revealed religions of all stripes. So he was unique. He was really the first to establish a system and spread that system. For a half year, the Rabbanim in Amsterdam argued with him and pleaded with him and then just put him in cherem. In 1656, his name literally crossed off the register of the Jewish community there. Spinoza moved to The Hague. He wrote his master work that was called Theological Political Tractate. If you wonder if a movie was ever made from that, no, the rights were never optioned with a name like that. And the truth is, Spinoza was not well known until the 19th century, when he became the patron saint of secular Jews. In a sense, he was the first secular Jew, the one whose influence would make modern biblical criticism respectable in the circles in which it was respectable, and quite an infamous Jewish figure. He died at age 45, a pauper, estranged from family and faith. So he could have been a centurion because he has influenced Jewish life, not for good. But there's another rogue who had greater influence, and until our day. But to arrive at the centurion of the 17th century, we have to first examine the defining Jewish event of the 17th century, what became known as the Gzeras Tach V'Tat, the Chmelnytsky massacres. Bogdan Chmelnytsky led a rebellion of Ukrainian Cossacks against Polish landowners in the 1640s, but he really stepped it up in 1648. His grievances were economic and religious, and both factored into his hatred of Jews. The Jews who were his targets ran the estates of the Polish nobility, and the Jews were in charge of collecting taxes from the Ukrainian serfs. So that was not a healthy arrangement. Add to that, Ukrainian Orthodox Christians despise the Polish Catholics and the Jews even more. As Chmelnytsky went through the rampage through the Ukraine and through Poland and through Lithuania, attacking the Poles, he attacked the Jews as well. There are occasions even when he attacked the Poles, and the Poles, in order to save their lives, turned on the Jews themselves and ferreted the Jews out of hiding and turned them over to Chmelnytsky. The fury with which they attacked the Jews, these Cossacks, was unmatched for centuries before or after. It began on the 20th of Sivan in 1648, and after finished, that became the fast day, Chof Sivan, when the town of Nemirov in Ukraine was invaded. In a matter of days, 6,000 Jews were murdered, most of them tortured to death in gruesome ways, drowned in the river, set fire to in the shul, butchered with knives, pregnant women having their fetuses cut out, Jews skinned alive, children roasted to death with their parents forced to eat them, and then they too were murdered. These were the Cossacks of Khmelnytsky. If we didn't know from our own experience that all this could happen, so we would think it was an exaggeration, but it wasn't an exaggeration. The numbers of Jews who were killed remain disputed. Our figure from our Sfarim report that within 6 months, some 100,000 Jews were murdered, maybe a third of the Jewish population alive at the time. But we do know an easy calculation is that hundreds of communities in Poland and Lithuania and Ukraine were destroyed. Many Jews were forcibly converted as well. Conversion then could save a person from death. And sporadic attacks continued for a decade. What do you say about such a person, Khmelnytsky? He remains a national hero in Ukraine because they see the narrow activity, the narrow accomplishment of freeing Ukraine from the Polish nobility. So Khmelnytsky to this day has a city named after him in Ukraine. It's called Khmelnytsky. There's a big monument in his honor in the main square in Kiev, and his face still appears on some banknotes, Ukrainian money, which is not worth that much in any event. Now the Jewish people labored to adjust to the catastrophe and to rebuild afterwards, as is our pattern, helping Agunos, reclaiming the forcibly converted who wanted to return, and reestablishing the communities. And like the Churban itself, and in contemporaneous literature, the Khmelnytsky massacres are referred to as the Churban Ashlishi, the third Churban, and the Crusades, and the expulsion. All this came upon the Jews unexpectedly, even if the warning signs were there. But the shock was great, and the longing for stability and redemption even greater. Jewish tragedy has always been followed by spiritual rebirth, and in almost every case by the rise of charlatans who prey on people's weaknesses and vulnerabilities and dreams. So after the expulsion, there were several famous Mashiach Sheker who would sprout up and raise hopes and then disappear, usually killed or jailed. But none of the failed false messiahs from the 16th century could hold a candle to, or in fact had the enduring impact of our 17th century centurion, the enigmatic, charismatic, Turkish-born Shabtai Tzvi. He's really the first out-and-out rogue that we've had as a centurion, but there's no doubt, as we'll see, his influence has lingered for centuries on the Jewish people down to today, and his story is a telling one, and something that we should realize. It's recurred a number of times. So Shabtai Tzvi's background is somewhat mysterious, despite being heavily documented. Most assume he was born in Smyrna, now called Izmir in Turkey, in 1626. Some have born elsewhere, but raised. Everyone agrees he was raised in Izmir. He was allegedly born on the 9th of Av, on Tisha B'Av, but that seems to be a later embellishment to frame his messianic credentials. Everyone agrees he was raised and educated in Torah in the yeshiva in Izmir. His father Mordechai was a successful merchant, Izmir being a major port in western Turkey on the Aegean Sea. And his primary Rebbe was the great Rav Yosef Eskapa, who was a Rosh Yeshiva in Izmir, in Smyrna, for more than 30 years. By all accounts, Shabtai Tzvi was a brilliant, but eccentric, but a brilliant, capable student. He received smicha, becoming a chacham, in the parlance of the Sardim, in his late teens, but already exhibiting the strange behavior that would mark his entire life. Shabtai Tzvi, as a late teenager, began to learn Kabbalah, usually alone. He became an ascetic. He became a self-flagellator, a frequent tovel at the mikveh, and a recluse. Now, if you take all those things together, you can interpret it as indicia of a great tzaddik or of a great meshugana. One of the two. They usually don't go together. One of the two. clearly his contemporaries in Smyrna saw him as a Meshuggah. Based on this, others would see him as a great tzaddik. He claimed to have mystical visions, and all in all, already in his early 20s, presented with symptoms of mental illness, a manic depressive psychosis that alternated between periods of great illumination and arousal and absolute dysfunction. And to his later followers, that became part of his charm. Before he was 24 years old, he had been married twice and divorced almost immediately, having never consummated the marriages. In 1648, he was 22. Apparently, after the news of the Chmelnytsky massacres reached Smyrna, he began pronouncing the Shem Hashem, Yud Kei Vav Kei, in public, and might even have declared himself the Mashiach at that point, but it was a claim that was derided and then ignored in his hometown. Memo to false messiahs, and probably the real one too, don't start your career where people remember you as a teenager. Not a good idea. It was soon after this, and long before he had achieved national renown, that Rabbi Yosef Iskapa, his erstwhile Rebbe, put him in Cherem and told him to get lost from Smyrna. Get lost? He did. Shabtai Tzvi began traveling through Turkey and Greece, spending a long time in Salonika. Like many people who are a little off, he was popular, he was charismatic, he had a beautiful singing voice, and he had a propensity to violate the Torah and justify it. Always something that can win a person friends in certain circles. As he traveled around in the 1650s, he also attracted attention for his bizarre conduct that again endeared him to some people because it was different. Look, we all go to shul, it's all the same. When you have something a little different, some people are drawn to that. In one setting, he married a Sefer Torah in shul under a chuppah. He's the chassan, the Sefer Torah was the kallah. Another time he celebrated all three regalim, Pesach, Shavuos, and Sukkos, in 1 week, infuriating the hotel industry. In another circumstance, this became a constant in his life, he ate non-kosher food and recited the bracha, Matir Isurim, blessing God is the one who permits the forbidden. Instead of we say in the morning, Matir Asurim, he frees the incarcerated. Matir Isurim, he would say that bracha before he sinned. He returned to Smyrna in the late 1650s, staying a few years. He was regarded as an eccentric, but ignored basically. And he was again expelled in 1662 after Yosef Iskapa died. Just a brief diversion. It's interesting how there was a time when the Rav could tell a person, get out of town, and the person would listen. He would get out of town. I think those days are long gone. He traveled again. Now, his father worked as a merchant and made some money late in life, but it seems that his brothers were wealthy, and there's no other explanation how he was self-sufficient. He must have been supported by his brothers. He traveled, sailed south through stopping in Rhodes, and then on to Cairo. In Cairo, he married again for a third time, marriage stuck, a girl named Sarah, also a weirdo. She was an orphan from the massacres in 1648, who bounced around Europe, winding up in Amsterdam, and then traveling across Europe. By all accounts, she was a prostitute. That's how she made her living, and she'd come to Cairo also. So he met and married her in Cairo in 1664, apparently attracted to the parable of the Navi Hosea of being married to a prostitute. She also clearly wasn't saying, but they became a couple. From Cairo, they made their way, and everyone finds their own level. From there, they made their way to Yerushalayim, where he settled into relative stability, even praying to Hashem that God should relieve him of his inner demons. He traveled the country to Tzfat, to Hebron, to Gaza, and there in Gaza, his career took another turn. In Gaza, he met another mystic, known as Natan of Gaza, Natan Ha'azati, Nathan of Gaza. Natan claimed supernatural powers and insights for himself. And when the two met, the meeting was as combustible and fiery as when Smith met Wesson. They were natural together. Shabtai Tzvi went to see him to cure his troubled soul. He was that type of mystic that the people like that still today. They claim they could heal you by just looking at you and talking to you. He went, Shabtai Tzvi did, to Natan of Gaza to be cured of his maladies, and Natan of Gaza convinced him that he was the Mashiach. And that Natan had had visions of Shabtai Tzvi as Mashiach, and now it was time to go public. They didn't do it right away. They talked, they traveled the land of Israel together, until Shavuos of 1665, when Natan announced the arrival of the Mashiach with himself as the Navi. Within days, all this is recorded, it was the 17th of Sivan, it's 10 days after Shavuos, Shabtai Tzvi publicly revealed himself in Gaza as the Mashiach and began a triumphant tour of the land of Israel. Now, he cut an impressive figure, if you think about it. He was well versed in Torah and in Kabbalah. He probably looked the part. We picture the drawings that he wore, a turban, he had a beard, he had flowing robes. He rode the land on horseback, even circling Yerushalayim 7 times on horseback, making the claims that he did, and the excitement in the land of Israel was palpable. The Rav of Gaza, Rabbi Yaakov Najera, who is the grandson of Rabbi Yisrael Najera, the poet, the Kari Bone, among others, his grandson was the Rav in Gaza at the time, he was ecstatic. Other rabbis in Israel joined in as well. Still others, of course, like Rabbi Yaakov Chagiz, who's a yeshiva, yeshiva Beis Yaakov in Yerushalayim, where Natan of Gaza had learned, were bitter opponents. They saw through it right away. He did, and others. And so in Yerushalayim and Eretz Yisrael, Shabtai Tzvi was banished yet again, but this time he was not silenced. He was not silenced because he had Natan of Gaza working the PR and the populist angles. And with that, he attracted far-ranging support. Immediately they endeared themselves to people. He announced the abolition of the fast days. If I did that, I'd be popular too. No longer necessary because Mashiach had come. The Gula is starting. He began sending letters across the Jewish world, Natan of Gaza, of the deeds of this Mashiach. Even though there were no miracles, he asserted, Natan did, that Mashiach did not have to perform any miracles, which accord with the Rambam's opinion, but nor does Mashiach have the power to annul halacha. Now the news from Israel swelled Shabtai Tzvi's popularity, fed avidly by a rumor mill that exceeded anything we can imagine today on the internet. So from Israel, it was reported in Turkey, in Europe, that Shabtai Tzvi had conquered Mecca, conquered Arabia. He had discovered and liberated the 10 tribes. Natan of Gaza said the prophecies of the Kabbalah had come true, and that anyone who opposed Shabtai Tzvi would suffer great afflictions. Because of the travel distance from country to country, it was impossible to verify, and therefore the claims stuck. They took root, and people believed them. He even predicted that the Sultan of Turkey would first acquiesce to Shabtai Tzvi's messianic pretensions, and then rise against Shabtai Tzvi as part of Chevlei Mashiach. Well, the reaction, the Jewish world was in a frenzy. Shabtai Tzvi returned to Smyrna in September of 1665, keeping a low profile that could not be maintained. Well, when Rabbi Yosef Eskapa's successor, Rav Aaron LaPapa, put him in Cherem, others were more circumspect amongst the Rabbanim, but the people, by and large, were euphoric. He acted strangely enough that people sensed something different about him. And by Chanukah, a majority of Smyrnans were in his camp. And then again he reverted to his weird behavior, proclaiming the Shem Hashem in shul in public, donning royal robes, eating treif again with the bracha Matir Isurim, and for good measure throwing in the occasional orgy. Now, it got so bad that his followers were called the Maminim, the believers, And his opponents in Smyrna and other places were minority, were called the Kofrim, the heretics. The heretics held the fort, but with little success. As Smyrna was a port and trading town, merchants from as far away as Poland and Germany and the Netherlands began sending word back home of this new development in Jewish life. And in the wake, we're less than 20 years after the Chmielnytskyi massacres, in the wake of those massacres, there's no doubt the Jewish soul was primed for good news. People wanted to believe, even if it wasn't true, and they reacted as if they did believe. In December 1665, again, those who knew him best, the local rabbis in Smyrna, again acted to try to ban him, but now he was too numerous. Shabtai Tzvi and his followers stormed into the shul, actually breaking down the door of the shul with an axe. He removed the Torah. He read a different portion in the Torah than this. He did this on Friday. This happened on Shabbos. He read a different parsha. He called men and women to the Torah in random order, always the sign of a false Messiah. And he demanded everyone in shul use the Shem Hashem, the Shem HaMefarash. Reb Chaim ben Veniste, he was the author of the Knesset HaGdol, a major work on the Shulchan Aruch, and a Rav in Smyrna opposed Shabtai Tzvi and demanded proof of his mission, of his credibility. Shabtai Tzvi flew into a rage. He then put Reb Chaim ben Veniste in Cherem and apparently even convinced him briefly, with Reb Chaim becoming a supporter. He later publicly retracted. But in the interim, Shabtai Tzvi deposed Rav Aaron LaPapa as the Rav in Smyrna and appointed Reb Chaim ben Veniste in his stead. Some rabbis who opposed Shabtai Tzvi still were forced to flee by the terrorists who supported Shabtai Tzvi. And he began to be referred to as Adonenu Malkenu Yorum Hodo, our master, our king, may his majesty be exalted. And he asked publicly that people begin to prepare to accept his kingship and return to Israel. Well, the Jewish world was in turmoil, even hysteria. Messianic fervor was at a fever pitch. In southern Europe, the Mediterranean basin, closest to Turkey, Jews began selling their homes and their possessions to prepare for Aliyah. In Poland, Lithuania, and Germany, Jews were perplexed. The Taz himself sent his son and son-in-law to investigate. They met Shabtai Tzvi, and they came back unable to decide whether he was for real or not. Great rabbis were on both sides of the matter. And across Europe, Jews walked the streets with pride. Think about it, from being downtrodden, beaten, and humiliated. Now they had a king who may have already conquered Arabia and was going to conquer Yerushalayim and bring them back to the land of Israel. And across Europe as well, many Jews widely adopted some of the weird practices of their master, the afflictions, the flagellations, the constant tevila in the mikra, even the multiple fasts. It's very interesting. Shabtai Tzvi abolished all the existing fasts, but he imposed numerous other fasts of his own choosing. In Amsterdam, Rabbi Yaakov Sasportas denounced Shabtai Tzvi as a charlatan, had to flee for his life. While in 1666, a Sefer Haftaros was printed in Amsterdam. You see this in the Encyclopedia Judaica, they have the title page. Under the heading, on the title page of the Sefer Haftaros, it says, Ateres Tzvi, the crown of Tzvi, Shabtai Tzvi Melech Yisrael Mashiach Elokei Yaakov, that's the title. And it says Sefer HaTorah, the whole year for Ashkenaz and Sephardim. At the very bottom it says, in the year Am Nosha Bashem. Nosha is bolded in Gematria, 426, is the year 5426. And then it says underneath, Hi Ashana Rishona L'chidush HaNevuo U'machut. It's the first year for the renewal of prophecy and royalty in Israel. The Jewish world was divided between supporters and opponents and those in between. By this time, whatever else we say about him, Shabtai Tzvi himself was a true believer. Now, Shabtai Tzvi was clever enough to, all this time, avoid any direct confrontation with the non-Jewish authorities. But eventually it had to come to that, and when he called for the conquest of the land of Israel and Yerushalayim, part of the Ottoman Empire, that became an open insurrection. Now, interestingly, the Sultan here treaded very lightly because Shabtai Tzvi was popular with non-Jews as well. So he had previously set himself up in a royal court not far from the palace in Constantinople, Istanbul. But when he called publicly for the recapture of Yerushalayim, that already was too much for the Sultan. Shabtai Tzvi was arrested at sea in February 1666, it's less than a half year since he's back, in the Sea of Marmara outside Istanbul, was put in prison. Most of his prison stay was not in a dungeon, but in very comfortable quarters, in which the Sultan allowed him to receive his followers. Shabtai Tzvi was soon transferred to Gallipoli. It was right before Pesach. Before he left, the Kadarko slaughtered a carbon Pesach, roasting it in its fat and eating it. All, of course, Asur, all again with his favorite bracha, Matir Isurim. But his arrest and his incarceration actually bolstered his reputation, because now he was a suffering Mashiach as well, and one that, out of character, the Sultan could not seem to execute. I mean, they chop off people's heads for less than this. And for some reason, the Sultan was keeping him alive, and this seemed to add to his mystique. All this despite the further excesses of Shabtai Tzvi, calling himself the Chasan HaTorah, and finally claiming to be God himself. To the people, though, he conducted himself in prison with the dignity associated with royalty. In August of 1666, he's still in prison after another canceled Tisha B'Av. Another false messiah arose, and they hate competition, Nechemiah HaKohen of Lvov. He denounced Shabtai Tzvi to the Sultan for sedition. When he was arrested, he promised to convert to Islam. He got an audience with the Sultan, and that gave the Sultan the idea to end this chapter once and for all. He had Shabtai Tzvi transferred from Gallipoli to Adrianople, and there Shabtai Tzvi was offered the choice of apostasy or death, conversion to Islam or execution. He chose the former, conversion, and in the Sultan's court, on September 15th of 1666, a little over a year since he publicly proclaimed himself Mashiach, Shabtai Tzvi converted to Islam. He took the name Aziz Mehmet Efendi. He was given a royal pension and an apartment, and he lived out his life. Now, in truth, he was apparently dejected by this turn of events, but nothing compared to the dejection and the revulsion that swept the Jewish world. Most Jews who had supported Shabtai Tzvi now renounced him and tried to pick up the pieces of their shattered faith. What's fascinating is that a strong minority clung to him, seeing this as just another trial and redefining his messianic mission, grasping at straws to rationalize his apostasy. Natan HaZati, who had never left Gaza this whole time, pronounced this, when he heard about it, an enigma that would be revealed over time. And he saw it as another attempt to lift up the holy sparks that would need to be perfected to bring the redemption. So he, Natan of Gaza, tried to develop a notion of an apostate Messiah, like others have tried to redefine the nature of Mashiach to account for their own disappointments. Rather than being a sign of heresy, Natan said, Shabtai Tzvi's apostasy was part of the whole plan. So Jews should be patient. He traveled to see his master. It's not known if they met. He did spend the rest of his life, though, in Europe. And he did insist that notwithstanding his incarceration and his conversion, Shabtai Tzvi was still the Mashiach. This went on for a decade until Shabtai Tzvi died on Yom HaKippurim in the year 1676, until apparently still believing in himself and still claiming to have visions. Over the years, he continued to observe some Jewish rituals while living as a Muslim. Natan of Gaza died 4 years later, 1680, in Skopje in Macedonia, still proclaiming the truth of the mission of Shabtai Tzvi. Well, what led to this debacle and what ensued thereafter, and how has it shaped Jewish life since? Undoubtedly, the Chmelnytsky massacres laid the groundwork for the appearance of a false messiah. Tragedies always engender discussions of why and how and what next and what's the deeper meaning. Is it right for Mashiach? And this was no different. And it seems that his first claims coincided with the first reports of the devastation of Chmelnytsky. There was also a new intellectual force that had permeated Jewish life that sowed the seeds for this, unintentionally perhaps, and that was the Kabbalah of the Ari. The Ari's Kabbalah was deeply immersed in discussions of redemption and how to bring redemption. Different from the earlier Kabbalah, the Zohar that was studied, that focused on God's nature in the world and how man should perfect himself in God's world. This is different. The Ari posited that man had an obligation to perfect the world, that God contracted himself, so to speak, and his will, to allow man free will, and that man was obligated to retrieve the broken vessels of creation that were scattered about, repair them, tikkun, in order to bring the geula. The Jewish people in the ensuing century after the Ari became very interested in what would or could bring redemption. And this played into that as well. Added to that is the widespread notion, based on a calculation of the Kabbalah of the Ari, that 1648 was a messianic year. It was a year that was appropriate, that was ripe for the Geula to come. People sensed that something awesome was going to happen that year, 1648, and they were right, but not in the way they thought they were. That being said, the blame goes first and foremost to the perpetrators, the Shabtai Tzvi and Natan of Gaza, turned out to be fakes, phonies, and frauds, and then to the Jews, who were somewhat gullible, grasping at straws, looking for shortcuts, something that didn't end with Shabtai Tzvi. So what would happen to the movement after the apostasy, after the death of the leader of the movement? The truth is, it's still with us to some degree and has shaped many different movements, events, and individuals since. His direct followers endured another century, but in fact he has followers down to this day. There are approximately 100,000 so-called Donme in Turkey who are identified as followers of Shabtai Tzvi. They maintain some very odd rituals, but they're not officially recognized as Jews by the Jewish community in Turkey. If things happen at dawn on the Bosphorus, things like that. There was an article in the Jerusalem Post magazine, must be now 4 or 5 years ago, that profiled this group, about 100,000 strong, that define themselves as followers of Shabtai Tzvi, and of course much of it is secret. They're Muslims on the outside, and they have the rituals and the ideas from him that they do in private, and some of them, in fact, have achieved high positions in the Turkish government. I think one said that one of their followers was a prime minister in the 1990s. But indirectly, Jewish life became more suspicious of innovators and more traditional as well. So you find thenceforth great Jews were accused of being closet Sabbateans. Rav Yaakov Emden made a career out of it at different times, publicly accusing the Ramchal, Rav Moshe Chaim Lutzato, and Rav Yonasan Ibishitz of being closet secret followers of Shabtai Tzvi. Nothing to do with each other, but Ramchal was in Italy, Rosenheim was his neighbor in Germany. But nonetheless, they were a little different, a little mystical, and he had other issues with them, including the use of amulets and other mystical pronouncements, and he just labeled them followers of Shabtai Tzvi, and that was a label that stuck. People were afraid. The nascent Hasidic movement in the 18th century was also suspected by the Misnagdim. Not so much of being followers of Shabtai Tzvi, but of introducing new things, and people became afraid of what the Kabbalah could bring. The same accusation was made against the Zionists a century later, the religious Zionists in our time, again, not of being followers of Shabtai Tzvi directly, but of evoking a false messianism that is not grounded in Torah and will eventually self-destruct. with much of Klal Yisrael with it. So one of the legacies of Shabtai Tzvi is really a stagnation that has descended on Jewish life, because anything new is filtered through the prism of, is this something that we can assimilate, or some that must be rejected? Other false messiahs also arose, most infamously Yaakov Frank in the 18th century. Many Jews lost faith in the redemptive aspects of Torah, and that fertilized the soil for the rise of Jewish secularism and reform a century or so hence, again aided by Spinoza's writings. And for sure, more closely to our day, Chabad has been tarred by these accusations in the recent past, just like the Sabbateans changed the rules and positive Mashiach who could violate the Torah. It's the elements of Chabad that support the notion of a dead Messiah, they have evoked the exact same criticisms. It also seems to have induced in Jews a blind faith, even to failed policies, constructing defenses and rationalizations to failed policies because of an inability to rethink critically and to analyze and to admit error. So despite everything that was happening, all the warning signals, all the red flags, that the guy was Meshuga, and the guy was an Avarion, and the guy represented nothing traditional about Torah Jewry, and was the farthest thing from Mashiach, once he was pronounced, and the excitement grew, people could not take a second look, and they were just swept away by it. In all the relatively short life of Shabtai Tzvi, who left no physical heirs, has deeply affected Jewish life since. Everything new is evaluated through the prism of its similarity or dissimilarity to what he wrought in the Jewish world, destruction and despair, but also the realization that indeed the redemption can be just moments away. If only we observe the Torah and pursue our destiny as the Torah has spelled out for us in a century that was marked by turmoil and confusion and upheaval, there's no person that is more representative of that confusion and turmoil and upheaval than our centurion Shabtai Tzvi. I thank you all very much.